agenda. I'm just going to open up a work session on House Bill 3092. Ms. Harris, what's the scoop?
Thank you, Ms.
This is the bill that we adopted amendments that made the bill irrelevant.
Yes, that is, in fact, correct, Madam Chair. So we're back again with House Bill 3092B. We have legislative counsel to explain why and how we got to this point, and Mr. Taylor is going to walk us through
the legislature's become irrelevant.
The Dash 7 conflict amendment. Thank you.
That's very funny. All right. Good afternoon. Welcome. Appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Thank you, Chair Brown, member Chuck Taylor, Deputy Legislative Counsel. When this was before you previously, we were called for a conflict check with the House Bill 3092A5 amendment. And those amendments change ORS 455.483. In running the check, we found that that statute was also amended by House Bill 3304, which had already been passed and signed by the governor. So the two changes to that statute are not really reconcilable. They reflect differing policy choices. So determining how to resolve any conflict basically is a policy choice and something that LC cannot do. We basically had two alternatives. Either the committee could adopt an amendment that undoes the change in House Bill 3304 and substitute House Bill 3092 in its place, or if 3304 in fact reflected what the committee wanted, then House Bill 3092 should simply not advance. So the conflicts team was instructed to check with the committee and see whether in fact they wanted any type of amendment or whether 3092 should simply be stricken from the schedule. Last I heard, they were waiting to hear back from the committee. I understand from your administrator, she did not hear from us, wasn't part of the decision making. But the when I saw the committee amendment printed, it didn't do either of the two options.
Okay. So I have the Dash 7s in front of me. They basically did what the original bill did, with the exception of they include an emergency clause. Is that correct?
Senator Brown, they are similar to 3304.
I see the
they
language
make a modification
change
to it.
That would be on lines 11 and 12, located in jurisdictions that offer electrical code plan review services.
Right. Since the amendments have an emergency clause on them, we can simply repeal Section 2 of House Bill 3304 without having to give further amendments to the language. So if that is the committee's pleasure, they can adopt that or some other amendment that undoes 3304. Or if, in fact, 3304 is the policy that you want, then the simple answer is you don't pass this bill out.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Is there someone here on behalf of House Bill 3092?
Yes.
JL.
Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. Chair Brown and members of the committee, J.L. Wilson representing the Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors. 3092 is our bill. What 3092 does in the Dash B7 amendments is it incorporates the elements of 3304 that were passed and also adds our element, which was agreed to by the plumbing industry, the League of Oregon Cities, and the building officials, which is lines 13, 14, and 15. Quite simply, in our bill, we wanted to give express permission to the director of DCBS to promulgate rules to determine what what is a complex structure and what is not. So we had certainty as to what plumbing plans needed plan review and which plumbing plans did not. We have pre-agreed to that rule. We asked for an emergency clause so we could just fly out of the chute with it and get it done. And so the B7 amendments repeals 3304 as it pertains to ORS 455.483, but this re-implements the language that 3304 does, as well as the language that we asked for. All the disparate interests are in agreement with this. We've already pre-agreed to the rule that we're authorized here, so I hope that that meets the committee's satisfaction.
Okay. So the lines 21 through 23 are referring to House Bill 3304, Section 2, Chapter 288 of House Bill 3304 is repealed. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Any questions? I think I got it. Sir Ringo? All right. Anybody else wishing to present us with further evidence on House Bill 3092? All right. I can't remember if I opened a public hearing, but it sort of became one, so we're open to work session on House Bill 3092. Chair would move the dash B7 amendments to House Bill 3092. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor if the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Would you like to carry?
Yes, I don't know.
Okay. Thank you so very much. All right. Let's move to House Bill 2103. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 2103, you said? Mm-hmm. House Bill 2103A changes the name of the Health Licensing Office to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency and makes some rectifying statutory changes. We have the dash A2 conflict amendment.
All right. Ms. Wilson? Come on up and tell us about this scintillating bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Susan Wilson, Health Licensing Office Director. We are a regulatory agency that provides the licensing, regulatory, administrative operations for 8 public and volunteer boards. We license 15 professions, and what we're asking for in this bill is simply, and quite simply, a change in the name for the Oregon Health Licensing Agency and to make the required conforming changes to the statutes concerning professions that we already regulate and make sure that the agency statutes continue to conform and we can carry out the duties that are necessary for each of those boards. And then issuance of a single facility license for certain facilities where practitioners currently have to hold 3 licenses. We're scaling that back as a regulatory streamlining effort, so those individuals only have to hold 1 license. In doing that, we have 2 remaining agency-regulated professions that still have specific fees within their statutes. We're eliminating floors and ceilings for those 2 remaining of the statutes that we currently regulate, and those are the 3 items that we're changing. I believe there is a conflict amendment also. Mm-hmm. One of the boards we regulate actually streamlined their process for endorsement, and we're fine with that.
Right. Questions for Ms. Wilson? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good to see you back again.
Thanks.
Anybody have any concerns? Any concerns? Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2103. Chair would move the dash A2 amendments, which are conflict amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? We should give you guys 3-day weekends more often.
Right.
So ordered. I'll carry. Let's just go down the list.
Sure.
All right. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2130. Ms. Harris.
Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 2130A directs the Environmental Quality Commission to establish fee schedules for suction dredge permits. It authorizes the commission to establish a fee schedule.
Okay. Anyone from the agency wishing to testify?
Again.
Why don't you come on out? Tell us why we need this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim McCall. I'm representing DEQ. 2130 establishes fees for suction dredge operations in Oregon and places those physically in statute. This is something that the mining community actually had asked for a few months back, and we worked closely with Representative Anderson and Butler, as well as other individuals in the legislature, and crafted this bill to place these fees physically in statute. We have no objection to the bill and actually believe that they will help us a little bit with the mining community because of again, placing these things, these fees physically in statute as opposed to a rule form.
Because it's easier for people to ascertain what the fees are? Is that the issue?
Part of the, Madam Chair, part of the reason that we're placing these in statute is the mining community has a higher level of trust in fees physically in statute as opposed to rules, and we're trying to work with them over the long term and things of that nature and trying to improve our relationships, so this is in part to deal with some of their concerns. The other part of the issue is that we have a $300 fee in here for individual permits, which would be a more complicated version of a general permit, and without that $300 fee, we would not be able to issue individual permits for larger operations or larger scale suction dredge operations. So that's the other component of this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions, Sarah Shields?
When you say larger scale suction dredge operations, how big is larger? How big is smaller? I mean, I don't have any idea of what you're talking about.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Shields, suction dredge miners typically have a unit that is can be floated in a small creek or stream and fit roughly in the back of a pickup. And the scale is really a question of how big the suction hose is that they physically are inserting into the stream bed. And the smaller, well, really all the way up to around 8 inches, would be within this range for these permit fees. Under a general permit, the way our program is structured, it anybody operating up to really 6 inches has the ability to get a general permit, and it then comes down to a question of whether or not they meet a turbidity standard, and if they can assure us that they meet that at a certain distance, then they qualify for a general permit. Generally, the larger permits, larger suction dredges between 6 and 8 inches, still relatively small, would qualify under a individual permit, and basically would require us to go through a little bit more involved permitting process as opposed to essentially a checkoff on a notification.
Any further questions?
Well, just kind of so the process works, that the suction up into some kind of screening system, and then the tailings or whatever go back into the water?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Shields. That's when they suck the material physically out of the stream or stream bank, it goes into a unit that, again, is physically floating out there and sluices it through a screen and then deposits it back physically into the stream.
And just to follow up, that turbidity you were talking about, is there any kind of regulation on that at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, two things. One, we are currently going through a new revision in a turbidity standard that will have an impact on all permitting standards statewide, specifically for suction dredge operations. They do create a certain amount of turbidity, but it tends to dissipate or disappear within 300 feet.
Oh.
And from our agency's perspective, that's a situation we're comfortable with and feel that kind of a regulation in place will not have a long-term impact.
In other words, this is a step in the right direction.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Ringo?
I wanted to follow up on one thing you said that I didn't quite track, was that without this, a certain type of mining can't take place?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, what we have in our, we just went through a renewal process, maybe step up, I'll step back a little bit. We went through a permit renewal over the last year, roughly, on this suction dredge permit. And what we had to address was basically bringing up to speed all the new standards and things of that nature and getting it physically in place. What we don't have in the permit is a rule or a specific language allowing us to write an individual permit to deal with those suction dredges that can't qualify under a general. And by having this $300 fee that's in here, we will be able to physically write a permit for an operation that can't qualify under the general, and we wouldn't be able to write this. We'd have to go through a separate rulemaking process in the interim.
And charges. And how much work is it to write the separate permit?
We've estimated that it is going to take an individual, perhaps a couple of days, perhaps longer. Part of this is we haven't had to do an individual permit in the past. And we're estimating that we're not going to see, hundreds of these coming out. Maybe it's only going to be a handful of individuals that would actually have an operation of that scale.
Do you have a fiscal analysis as far as how much you expect to receive as a result of this fee and how that compares with the overall workload?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, our estimate, I think, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I believe it was right around $73,000. It doesn't still quite pay for the overall issuance of this general permit or even the individual, but we think it's sufficient enough to cover our workload or the amount of permits that we actually anticipate writing. The alternative for us is the only individual permit fee schedule that we have out there is for the larger scale activities covered under an NPDES permit, and those are in excess of $9,000, and it clearly just doesn't fit the scale of this operation.
Right. You said you would expect to receive around $73,000, and that would not cover the cost of issuing the permits.
Not totally. This is a program that we have historically not collected fees to match the physical service and the overall permit program. It just physically works out into the formula and being able to pay for the other general permits, yeah.
What's the expected cost of supporting this then? I mean, if $73,000 would bring in, what's going to be the cost to the department?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I don't have a specific number with me today. I could certainly get back to you on.
Okay. Just one more.
You keep saying that, Senator.
Oh, I know I do. My understanding is that the at least for some type of permits, and I don't know if this is NPDES or other types, that the state of Washington has, the fee program supports itself. Is that your understanding? Does Washington have that? And is there a reason we can't be moving in that direction?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I'm actually not familiar enough to be able to respond to what takes place in Washington. All I can offer is that within our permitting program, it's a combined fee as well as a source of other funds and things of that nature that the agency receives.
I see. Okay. Just a comment, Madam Chair. I would like to see DEQ start moving to a system where if people want to use our state waterways, whether it's for discharge purposes, and in this case it's mining, that at least be self-sustaining instead of asking for the public support. So just a comment.
Thank you. Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Prior to the discussion, which took over a year in a working group, weren't these suction miners allowed to enter the streams and for recreational mining without permits?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrioli, we had a fee permit system in place and have had a fee permit for suction dredge or placer miners for the better part of the last two decades. So they would have been required to have a permit to legally enter water bodies and carry out their activities.
What was the fee?
The fee at that time was between $40 and $60. We generally applied that to suction dredge operations in excess of 4-inch diameter hose. And we also had the ability to charge additional fees for issuing a permit or an annual compliance fee or something of that nature that we generally waived for those activities.
So from $40 to $60 for a site permit to a $300 general permit?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, the general permit actually is only $25 per year, and we're also allowing a $100 to basically give them a $25 break over a five-year period. The $300 fee is only for an individual suction dredge permit, and it will only likely affect less than 5% of the suction dredge operations that are out there.
So, Madam Chair, I perceive we are moving to a place where the fees are increasing, and that we have been in a place where the fee revenue generated wasn't quite covering the cost. It may still be that situation, but it looks like it's a significant improvement. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. We're going to close the public hearing temporarily on 2130 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2238. Representative Cromwell, why don't you come on forward? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2238 requires the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to offer consolidated applications for people seeking either a renewal of a limited or full on-premises sales license when they're applying for both the liquor license and a video lottery game contract.
Mr. Linden, do you want to come up? Go ahead. I'm going to have Mr. Linden come join you.
Okay. Madam Chair, for the record, State Representative Jerry Cromwell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, over to Gaston. This is an issue that that we worked on in the interim with the Government Operations and Oversight Committee, of which I was a chair, and I carried this bill on the House floor, and I just came here simply to, I saw it on your agenda, to answer questions. I don't have any
great
prepared testimony.
Mr. Linden.
Madam Chair, for your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Restaurant Association. Many of our members are licensees of both the Lottery Commission as well as the Liquor Commission. In order to have lottery, you have to have a liquor license first. We watched this bill and worked with it during the interim. We think it makes great sense. These agencies are fully capable of putting together a consolidated application process that applicants can certainly work with and benefit from. It ought to be more efficient for the agencies, more efficient for the licensees. All the fees get paid. I mean, there's no fee breaks here. So we think it's a good government type of initiative and would strongly recommend its approval by the committee.
All right. Questions? I think you're off the hook, Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You too, Mr. Linden. All right. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2238. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2130. Mr. Moskowitz, where did you go? Come on up.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz with the Wild Salmon Center in Portland, Oregon. And I have just a question about House Bill 2130. In Section 1, it actually notes that ORS 196840 is repealed. And I looked that up in the ORSs, and it's actually what we believe is a helpful piece of statutory language for the Department of Water Resources, and it seems misplaced with the fee setting for the suction dredge mining, which we have no issue with at all, but we would urge you to look at that section. That repeal is not necessarily in the public interest. It would remove a tool that other agencies and the Water Resources Department have to protect a basin. The language that's, if I could take just a quick second and read the language that is repealed, any agency listed in ORS 196.825 may request Water Resources Commission by rule to close one or more specified waters of the state to issuance of permits after a public hearing is held in conformity with the Oregon APA if the Water Resource Commission finds that issuance of permits with respect to such water resources would be inconsistent with the protection, conservation, and best use of the water resources of the state as specified in ORS 196805, the Water Resource Commission may by rule close such waters to issuance of permits and any other removals or fills under Section 196850. For an indefinite period of time or during such other times as stated in the rule. And so that, it gives other state agencies and the Water Resource Commission the ability to close a basin to further withdrawals. And it may be that an irrigation district would want to ask an agency to invoke this, angling groups or fishing groups. It seems like it's a good provision of law, and we would urge that it not be repealed.
So you have no qualms about the underlying rest of the bill, sections 2, 3, and 4?
None at all.
Okay. Mr. McCulley, you want to come on up for a minute? Can you tell us why you're repealing ORS 196.840?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're actually not. That, I believe, was a request at the Water Resources Department. When this bill was working its way through on the House side, we had nothing to do with it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's check it out. What? You're here? Somebody's here?
No.
Somebody's here.
John Lilly's here.
Ah, come on up. Now we are getting to the...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Lilly, Assistant Director with the Department of State Lands. This provision, 196.840, appears in the removal fill law. The provision, as has already been stated, directs the Water Resources Commission may close waters to removal fill activities. Something of a vestige of the way the statute was written many years ago when the Water Resources Commission or the Water Policy Review Board actually had more authority in the removal fill law. The bill was amended in the House Water Committee to provide for this repeal. This particular provision of law has not been implemented, in other words, not been used since it was made a provision of the law as far back as the late 60s, maybe the early 70s. I'm not precisely sure when it was enacted. Our view is that while we... since the provision hasn't been used, if there were circumstances when a removal fill permit may not be in the public interest for these purposes, then the department does have the authority to deny the permit and to later to work with the applicants to make sure that the proposal does not compromise the aquatic resources of the state.
All right, questions?
Yeah.
Senator Shields.
So in other words, you have a tool there that you've not used. You use different tools, and so you don't want to have this tool in your tool bag anymore.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, the tools that we have proven to be sufficient at this point. I'm sure that most mechanics don't want to throw tools out of their toolbox. But it's hard to argue effectively that this needs to remain since it hasn't been used and since it's been in the statute.
Other questions, Senator Ringo?
So who has suggested that this be removed, Water Resources Department?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, the amendment was made in the Senate, in the House Water Committee. I do not believe that it emanated from the Department of Water Resources.
Do we know where it came from, though? I mean, I'm just curious. I'd like to know who offered
it. Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, the Department of State Lands did ask for an amendment to 196.840 whereby the department would be the agency that would be making the decision on the closure rather than Department of Water Resources or the Water Resources Commission. We originally felt that that was a good plan since the Department of State Lands has full responsibility over the removal fill law in general. I think it was a committee decision in the House Water Committee to change or to make the amendment as presented to you today.
I think we've resolved the problem, Mr. McCarthy. If I can give him a mic, he'll tell us what's going on.
Gladly.
Well, you didn't all need to go, but that's okay.
Chasing away whenever I come.
Brendan to the rescue.
Brendan McCarthy with Legislative Council, for the record. The amendment to this statute in question was actually originally started with me during the interim looking at various ways to statutory improvement. It was clear to me in my review that the reference to the Water Resources Commission was a erroneous reference. In 73, I think, or 71, the statutes were converted from state engineer to water resources and DSL. These statutes were yanked out of Chapter 541, put into 196. This was one thing that appeared to have gotten missed. And when I mentioned that to DSL, then the review process started, and DSL said, we've not used this. We have authority elsewhere, and it appears to be superfluous.
All right. Questions? Mr. Moskowitz, does that make you feel a lot better?
It's okay. Mr. McCarthy is definitely okay
with us. Okay.
Thanks. His credibility just shot through the floor. tough break, man.
All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2130. You need to go here shortly. Let's move. Chair would open a work session on House Bill 2238. There were no amendments, I recall.
That's correct.
Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. You ready to move 2130? You feel comfortable on that?
No.
Okay. All right. I know. Who wants to carry OLCC stuff? Sarah Ringo.
Oh, I'd love to.
Thank you for volunteering. All right. Sarah Shields, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2265. These are huge amendments, so...
Yeah, everybody should be getting some amendments passed out, as long as they don't break the back of that fine lady who's distributing them right now. I think we ought to get Ann Hannes to come up and maybe explain these amendments a little bit to us all, and anybody else who wants to help.
Anybody else want to help? John, you're welcome to come on up. I think this is the... You want to come up?
Yes.
Okay. Just to warn everyone, these amendments don't pass the test, and the test is if they're still warm when we get them, we're not going to move them.
Right.
So we're going to give you all 24 hours to kind of read them, make sure there's no errors, all that kind of good stuff. So, all right. Okay. Good afternoon and welcome. Why don't you tell us what they do and, 3 minutes or less.
Sure.
Just kidding.
Thank you, Chair Brown. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, Director, Department of State Lands. What you have before you are amendments to House Bill B. Engrossed, House Bill 2265. Mm-hmm. House Bill 2265 started out as the bill for carrying the fee increase for the removal fill program. Also added to that bill was a fix for easements on state-owned waterways for the bill. That relates to Senate Bill 82 that was passed during the last legislative session. What we're asking you to do today with these amendments is to restore what was removed in the House of that removal fill fee bill. So if you look at B. Engrossed 2265, you'll see under that summary that whole area that was removed from the bill, these amendments mm-hmm. then restore that. What the amendments do in a nutshell is increase fees for certain removal fill permits. It sets new fees for removal fill authorization. It also sets new fees for services that relate to wetland jurisdictions determinations that are currently provided at no cost. And it also waives permit fees for habitat restoration projects, increases the fees by about 3% per year. The last time that there was a fee increase for the removal fill program was in 1987, and then it makes some housekeeping changes in the removal fill fee bill. The reason why we're asking for the fee increase is, one, it equalizes program support. There are some permits that we currently impose a fee on, and there are others like general authorizations that are currently free. Also, they're free for an emergency authorization. It increases the level of user support for the fees. Under the current law with the fees that we have, it covers less than 20% of the cost of the program. This would bump it up to about 30%. When the program was first established, it covered about 67% of the cost. And the last time it was increased in 1987 was about 40%. It allows more revenue to go into the common school fund because revenue that would otherwise go into the common school fund supports the removal fill program. The new wetland jurisdictional fee is one that's been asked for by wetland consultants and developers as a way for them to know up front where wetlands are so they can either minimize or avoid them. And they're also asking for a way to expedite those wetland delineations to be done. And then the last two reasons are that it rewards habitat restoration projects by waiving individual permit fees, and it adjusts the fee for from 1987 to $2,005 dollars. So I think I did that in 3 minutes.
Okay. Very impressive. All right, any questions? Senator Shields?
Yeah, we have been talking about some of this as it relates to budget down in the budget committee. Isn't that right?
Yes, you'll hear this because we have, with the wetland determination fee, we have a program option package to allow us to have a position so we can increase service levels on the wetland delineation as well as increase revenues for the Common School Fund.
So, Madam Chair, if I might summarize, maybe this sounds a little bit crass, but this seems like a bill that was pre-session filed by the Department of State Lands, and on the House, everything that was in this bill for you was kind of taken out, and they put in something that they wanted instead, and all you're doing is restoring the bill to what it originally was, or was originally intended to be.
Senator Shields, that is correct.
All right. Thank you, Senator Shields. Further conversation?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I guess I could figure this out by flipping through the... Okay, the thing that they added at the House was the part about the submersibles.
Right.
They took out your part and they added that part.
Yeah. Yes, and we have no objection to that part being added in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Lilly, did you wish to add anything? Okay. Sir Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, could I get an explanation of the 3% automatic fee increases?
Yes, what we had talked to our removal fill technical advisory committee and asked them, you know, what was most logical for doing a fee increase. And so what they thought was to have the same structure. We looked at what the average inflation rate has been since 1987, and that's what we increased it by from 1987 until now.
Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, would there be any need for further legislative authority to increase those fees?
We're asking the additional legislative authority to increase the fees so that they can then be increased as inflation goes up, and thus it's not as much of a drain on the common school fund.
I'm sure that was artful that it didn't get close to answering the question. I'm asking if this is an automatic fee increase for which you don't need any further legislative authority.
There isn't a section in there that allows for a 3% per year adjustment for permits beginning in 2007.
Okay. Is there a sunset on the bill?
No, there is not.
Any further questions? Thank you both very much. Appreciate your testimony. We'll let this one cool off for 24 hours. All right, let's go to 2510. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2510A modifies the statutes governing forgery in the first degree and expands the scope of those statutes to include certain other documents such as retail labels, sales receipts, etc.
All right. I have no one signed up to testify on House Bill 2510. Yeah. I'm like, okay, let's close the public hearing. We'll see if we can find a parent for this little orphan. Get a little testimony.
All right, let's go to 2561. All right, open a public hearing, 2561.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2561A designates the director of the Oregon Youth Authority as an ex officio juvenile compact administrator.
You must be Harry Gilmore.
That's correct.
Welcome.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Harry Gilmore. I'm the manager of the Technical Assistance Unit at the Children, Adults, and Families section of the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services supports House Bill 2561. Passage of this bill will transfer programmatic responsibility for the Juvenile Compact from the Department to the Oregon Youth Authority. The Juvenile Compact governs the transportation and supervision of juvenile delinquents when they go out of Oregon to be in another state and they're still on probation or parole. It also governs the return of escapees or absconders from the juvenile justice system. And it also governs juvenile delinquents who come to Oregon from other states while on probation or parole from another state.
Okay.
Because this compact deals almost exclusively with juvenile delinquents,
the transfer probably should have happened about 10 years ago.
Probably should have happened at the time the Youth Authority was created. The statute at that time designated the director of the Department of Human Services as the administrator of the compact, and this bill would change that, as well as having provisions for the logistics of transferring the budget and the staff positions associated with the program.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your testimony this afternoon. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2561, open a work session, 2561. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who'd like to carry?
Probably my turn.
Is that a yes? From Senator
Shields.
Probably
my turn.
Okay. All right. Let's go to 3491. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3491A creates the crime of disorderly conduct in the first degree for initiating a false bomb threat or other type of emergency threat involving schools.
On 2510?
3491.
Which bill? 3491.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for the warning.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was like, yeah, okay. Thank you. Ms. Suhanek? Did I get right? I like the... That's good. I probably just said Julie.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Julie Sahonic. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association, which represents 17 community colleges in Oregon and over 330,000 Oregonians. We're testifying today in support of House Bill 3491. Recently, Clackamas Community College experienced the havoc and the uncertainty that comes with bomb threats. We've also had other ones at Portland Community College's Rock Creek campus. The concern that comes with this is that the amount of uncertainty and actual fear that kind of creeps through the campus and is there for quite a while does wreak havoc on our ability for our students to feel secure, our faculty, and our administrators at their campuses. And what they have found is that with the current penalty in place, that it doesn't provide, it's basically a slap on the hand for those who call in these threats or similar threats for students, or for bomb threats. Uh-huh. And what this would do is give a tool for the police officers to discipline, for lack of a better word, those who provide these threats and hopefully act as a greater deterrent. When this budget was up in front of the House, Joe Johnson, who's president of the Clackamas Community College, testified, and when asked if he thought that if this bill was in place at the time, if the threat would have happened, after talking to the person who they do know called in the bomb threat for the campus, if he had realized that he could have been facing a felony or a steeper charge, that it is likely he wouldn't have called in the first place, and that cost and those fear that was provided on that campus would not have taken place. So we are definitely supportive of House Bill 3491 and urge you to move it forward.
Okay. Does anybody see or hear from Representative Hunt?
I did hear from him. He called. We talked about an hour ago. I wish he was here to speak to the bill, but I think the testimony you just heard makes the case right. for the bill itself.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ferriola.
The only question I have is, I think we all remember having enacted stiffer penalties for simulating an explosive device. That was last session, when we thought we had some people making threats against the dams, and they showed up with a simulated bomb. Are there no other statutes for a threat like this besides menacing? Menacing doesn't sound like a serious enough charge, or disorderly conduct. It sounds like I can understand why people would not feel that there's enough deterrent in the idea that you might be prosecuted under a disorderly conduct charge for a bomb threat. Yes, ma'am, I'm asking if you know of any other charges.
To be honest with you, I'm very proud of my master's degree, but I don't have a law degree, so I have no idea.
I think you should be extraordinarily proud of the fact that you do not have a law degree.
So I can't answer that question, Senator Ferriola.
Do you want to come up? Oh, we've got Judiciary Council here. Okay. We can bring him up.
Attorneys,
now watch it, Senator Ferrioli. Mr. O'Leary, why don't you come on up? Representative Hunt is under call. Would we be happier if we just pass the bill, or does he want to wait and testify on the bill?
I think he might testify.
Okay. All right, Mr. O'Leary, can you answer the question that Senator Ferrioli just asked that I don't even remember now what the question was?
I just was curious. Are there not a variety of criminal statutes under which a bomb threat could be prosecuted?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, I think the answer to the question is that there are. I think I'm going to sort of not quite answer, though, your question completely and point out the section of 3491 as amended that makes it significant is the change to the juvenile court statute 419C145 that lists the type of charges for which a juvenile court can order the pre-adjudication detention of a youth. Under current law, that can only be youth can only be held for a felony, a charge of a felony, and this bill makes it clear that a youth charged with a misdemeanor version of disorderly conduct under this section, the youth could also be detained. And the testimony on the House side was that the folks in the juvenile justice system felt that that would be appropriate so that they can assess the risk and evaluate the child, determine whether or not that is a child that really needs to be given intensive services or not.
Madam Chair, I thought this might be bomb threat light. But okay. It sounds to me like it's an improved apprehensive and prosecutorial tool to use in juvenile cases.
Thank you. I'm getting zillions of notes. Okay. Let's do this. I understand Representative Hunter's under call. I think I'd just like to go ahead and move the bill. We'll all say that Representative Hunt came and he urged us on an individual basis, and he is avidly in support of the bill, and we really appreciate his hard work on this bill. And with that, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session. Somebody want to move it?
Sure.
Senator Shields.
Move it.
Senator Shields has moved House Bill 3491 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Well, I would like to say that I also have part of this North Clackamas School District in my district, so I have I really identify with Superintendent Naso's testimony, if you had a chance to read it.
I do, too. So I'm with you on that one. Any objection? So ordered, and so Senator Shields will let you carry the bill. Hello, Representative Hunt.
Representative Hunt will write my speech for me.
We appreciate his very hard work. All right. All right. I understand that thank you, Senator Ferrioli, that the sponsors of House Bill 2510 are preoccupied at the moment. We'll let them off the hook today and try and reschedule that for tomorrow. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3495. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3495A allows malt beverage manufacturers that have certain tax liability in previous calendar years to deposit, to make a deposit with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission in lieu of posting the required bond.
Mr. Linden, why don't you come on up? I didn't know you and Mr. Perry were interchangeable, but that's nice.
Thank you, ma'am.
I don't know it either.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was about to say I don't know it either. But for your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Restaurant Association. House Bill 3495 deals with a very small number of brew pubs that brew a very small amount of malt beverage. And right now, these brew pubs are required to post a bond of $1,000 bond. In order to post a $1,000 bond, you're going to end up spending about $100 buying the bond. And these are brewers that brew such a small amount of specialty beer that their tax liability is actually less than $100 a year. So what 3495 is designed to do is to permit these types of brewers to pay to the Liquor Commission the full amount in a deposit of their previous year's tax liability in lieu of purchasing the bond that they'd otherwise be required to purchase. And again, once they break the amount in terms of volume, you know, they would be out of this program. But there's a small number of the brew pubs that choose to be very modest in terms of the amount of beverage they brew. And this would benefit them in the sense that they'd still be paying their full tax liability, but not going to the additional expense of having to purchase a bond at a amount that is higher than what their actual tax liability. So that's what 3495 does, short and sweet. I'd be happy to respond to any questions from the committee.
It's kind of a modestbrewy.com.
Does it promote brew making in Oregon?
I think it does. I think it many of our brew pubs started off very, very small in terms of a volume of beverage that they produced.
Well, I want to promote brew making in Oregon, so I'm fine with it. Tiffany, you want to vote and we'll just call it yes?
Yeah.
No, we'll call it good. Thank you.
I have to declare conflict.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that's to testify on this bill? Tiffany? Anybody else?
No, sir.
Okay, we'll just hold this one over, and I suppose she wants us. But she's here. So we can move this before Bill leaves.
Quick, move it.
Move it, quick. Move it, Chair. This will be a moving experience.
This is a fine order of things. Close the public hearing. No amendments, right?
Right.
Excuse me. Open a public hearing,
a work session
on House Bill 3495.
Madam Chair.
There we go.
I move House Bill 3495 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 3495 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes. Charlie likes carrying malt beverage, so he should carry the
beverage. Great. Well, I was just going to let him. Any objection? Hearing and seeing that. So ordered. Senator Ringo, you can carry. Thank you, Mr. Linden. Will you let Senator Farioli know that we went ahead and moved this bill? I wasn't too concerned, but Mr. Linden, you might wish to touch base with Senator Farioli and just let him know that we moved the bill and make sure you provide your stimulating testimony to him. Okay, public hearing, House Bill 3238. Ms. Harris, what do we have?
Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 3238A revises procedures for the review of agency rules by interim or session committees of the Legislative Assembly.
All right. It's Allen, isn't it? Allen? Okay. And then Ms. Franco.
Oh, Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Patrick Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I've got written testimony being distributed to you and a couple of additional items. I'm not going to go through the written testimony in any detail other than to say that the heart of this bill was a previously and differently introduced bill, House Bill 2188, that resulted from an interim task force created by the last legislative session to look at the issue of how agencies do administrative rules and how they take into consideration the impacts on business. This is a hearty perennial around legislative sessions. If you look at ORS 183, which is the Administrative Procedures Act, there are changes virtually every session to that act. This was a group, a copy of their report you have in front of you. I pointed out to you just for you to see the list of who was a member of that group to give you some idea of having tried to create a fairly balanced group to look at the question and see, are there some substantive changes we can make in administrative rule procedures to address these issues. A couple of highlights that are in this bill. There are a number of pieces here. A number of changes affect advisory committees. Agencies are required to do advisory committees. A lot of the work that happens in that process happens at the end of the process. At the very end of the process of doing administrative rules, agencies estimate the impact on fiscal impact on businesses, the public, on agencies. And so it doesn't have any opportunity to inform the design of the rule itself. And so one of the major provisions of the bill moves that work forward in the process. The piece, though, that I think you probably want to talk most about today is the language having to do with the waiver of rules. Joining me is Tom Gallagher, who was the vice chair and a member of the advisory committee, and I thought I'd start, if it would please the chair, to let Tom talk a little bit about the thinking of the advisory committee on that waiver language.
Thank you.
Madam Mr. Chair, Gallagher. Members of the committee, Tom Gallagher. I was on this committee. We're not representing anyone, but with an abiding interest in administrative law and the way the rule system works. On the committee, which you don't see in the report, there were two staff members from the Department of Justice, Phil Schradl, who is a special counsel to the AG, and Christina Shute, who does rulemaking for six or seven agencies. When the idea in the discussion came up about having to implement rules that made no sense and its impact on the rulemaking process, the negative impact of saying, why are we doing this? I'd summarize the discussion, which went on for about three different meetings, included the AG folks, and later on the administrative committee for the bar put in some amendments on the appellate process side in the House. I will sum it up at one point. In frustration, I looked at the group and I said, I think we should drop this. It's much easier to have a rule that has an absurd outcome than to try to figure out how to avoid it. And I think that's a gravamen of why that piece is still in there. There are a number of restrictions on how you would implement or make a decision that something was absurd. The two agency heads, Corey Streisinger and Stephanie Halleck, who were on there, said, basically, I can't see when we'd ever use this. It's too fraught with political risk to go out and say the Willamette TMDLs are absurd, and so we're just going to waive the application of the rule there. It would only apply in very small instances where all of the parties, where all of the discussions went along and said, this doesn't make any sense to do it this way. As a point, in fact, we could come up with very few examples which were so clearly absurd in the outcome that we haven't brought any forward. So our position on this all the way through the House was, look, if people look at this and are uncomfortable, and Pat and the AG dealt with all of the agencies in the interim as they raised objections or said, well, what does it apply here? Will it work here? And they worked through all of these. And we worked through all of them on the House side. We're willing to take that piece out. It is not essential to the bill. So as you think about taking it out, think about just the philosophy of rulemaking. What you are saying is there are no applications of rules that would be absurd. I'll give you one example we used, which was a landscape strip under a city regulation in an office building that was designed with all xeriscape plants during the water crisis of 3 years ago. the application of the rule for the city was the only thing we had to do was put in a sprinkler system. We had to landscape it, and we had to put in the sprinkler system. And we said, that's stupid. Why would we put in the sprinkler system with these plants? They said, I'm sorry, that's the way we interpret the rule. The person that came out to do the inspection was a horticulturist, PhD horticulturist from the University of Oregon, who went into the basement to see if the sprinkler system was hooked up. Now, landscaping strips is a good idea. Making them look something other than postage stamp pieces of junk with two bushes out there, which is what you see most of the time, is a better idea. But simply having the rule say, you got to put a sprinkler system in, otherwise the plants will die, and most developers don't care about the plants dying, so they just plant them and let them die, it results in an absurd outcome in many points and times. So that's what it's all about. It's there going through its third look now by a group of people saying, I wonder what evil we could do with this. I wonder what bad things could happen. And that's fine. Take a good hard look at it. It's not the heart and soul of this bill.
Let me wrap up by just giving you the very quick rundown of what that waiver section actually says. And I'm working from a side-by-side comparison of current law
that we have.
That you have, current law.
Madam Chair?
Sarah Ringo?
Just a clarification. Is this currently existing in the A engrossed version, or is this something...
This is currently in the A engrossed version.
And where in the A engrossed?
This is in Section 4.
Section 4.
And what Section 4 provides is that to consider waivers at all, they have to be consistent with the scope and intent of the underlying statute, not conflict with federal laws or regulations. To do waivers at all, an agency has to, if you will, adopt a waiver rule where they set out the criteria, process, whatever they're going to do for how they might consider waivers. Their decision whether or not to adopt a waiver rule or not is not a judicially reviewable decision. However, then any decision to grant a waiver has to meet certain findings, which are reviewable. The waiver is consistent with the objectives of the rule being waived and the statutes. Application in the particular circumstances leads to an absurd or undesirable result or cost of compliance that's substantially greater than contemplated. And if the agency declines a waiver under those circumstances, the option for judicial review is very limited. It's basically, was there a defect in the process that was followed, or was there a manifest injustice? On the other hand, if they grant the waiver, it's the standard judicial standard of review in those circumstances. So we've kind of run the ratchets in one direction, if you will, in that kind of a circumstance. Those provisions are in 4.2 B and C, I believe, as well as 4.3. And then waivers related to Measure 37 are specifically exempted.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, I just want to clarify. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm trying to follow you to go along mm-hmm. here. It says, line 11, it says, will lead to absurd or undesirable results.
Mm-hmm.
Not and, it says or.
That's correct.
So
did I say and?
Well, I was thinking
it's
and.
It's an either.
Either or.
Or it's not a both.
Correct.
So it's not just an absurd result. If it's undesirable in somebody's judgment, then it can be waived.
I think, Senator, that an undesirable result, getting the opposite of what you were trying to do, would be the essence of absurd.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but... my thought is that to say undesirable, one person's undesirable result is another person's desirable result.
Senator, that's very, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, that's very true. If you look at it in the abstract like that, gee, what if? If you go back through the conditions that Pat read, and you go back and look at an agency that actually has to get here, and then you look at the fact that their decision to waive is completely appealable, their denial of waiver is not, it is really set up for the use of the agency, for the agency to say, this isn't what we were trying to do with that. We couldn't cover every possible foreseeable outcome here. We've now created something that's completely unreasonable. I'll use an example that came out of the death of common sense, and that was the sisters of Mother Teresa in New York, who wanted to they bought an old building and wanted to use it for the homeless downtown, and they live in poverty. They were required to put freight elevators in the buildings because it was a three-story building, and put in all of the other amenities, not fire stuff, but all of the amenities for other uses. And these were people who lived like the people they were dealing with. In one sense, that's an absurd outcome for this group. You could say, okay, if you sell the building, the next people have to do it. This waiver only applies for the use of these Sisters of the Poor. And you've accomplished what you intended to accomplish with the rule. And I think that's where that's going.
Mm-hmm. Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, I guess the other thing to observe is that the language in 4C operates in interchange, if you will, with the language in 4B. That finding of undesirable has to be in a context of being consistent with the objective of the rule being waived and the statutes implemented by the rule. And so if we're achieving the right objective but creating some sort of an undesirable outcome, it almost, in a respect, doesn't matter whose undesirable outcome it is, as long as the objective being achieved is what's consistent with the original rule and with the statute. The last thing I'd like to mention is that I have had a very brief couple of conversations with League of Conservation Voters regarding this very language, and we're kind of talking through the issue of are there ways we might be able to tweak the language to make it operate in a way that makes sense and provides safeguards as an alternative to either leaving it as is or pulling it out completely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Frankel.
Thank you very much. Liz Frankel, League of Women Voters of Oregon. We have been quite concerned this session because of 2288 and some of the other rule bills, and this bill has been improved, certainly. It's had a lot of real weird stuff in it. At this present moment, we still do not like this procedure.
Section 4.
For one thing, right now, and the League's position begins with public interest, as you probably know, and that's why you have rules. The rules right now, you can amend rules, you can adopt them, you can suspend them, you can repeal them. This adds another layer. And the interesting thing is, when you suspend a rule now, that is for 180 days only. That is, and you have to justify that it's not going to harm or prejudice public interest. This rule allows for the waiver for 3 years, and then you decide whether it's doing good things or not, and then you go ahead. It seems to me that there are other ways of doing this. The ridiculous things, and I agree, they do occur. I've seen it myself. Usually way they adjust that is conditioning a permit or whatever you're doing, enforcing the rule. I don't think this is in the interest of the public. I think that it raises some judicial questions. There's a section where it talks about if you could combine any kind of rule waiver stuff with a contested case. That's down in sub 5. Then you're, of course, into a judicial review, a normal judicial review. It's a little bit unclear as to how judicial review is going to occur. It is also unclear to me why you have a 3-year waiver. And you realize this is not just, this could be a category of waivers. Who knows? I think this bears a lot of, yes, I have talked to Pat Allen. I have not talked to the League because this just came up today and I just talked to him. Whether we would accept and remove our opposition or not depends on some discussion. So I am saying, plus the fact that I hate to write anything that talks about particular circumstances. Like what? Absurd, like what? Undesirable. I mean, this is sort of dumb language to me. I simply say that I will consult with the League people. I have no idea what my committee will think.
Okay.
But I will carry that back to them.
All right. Well, we're not going to move this bill today. Probably put it on a back burner for a day or two, but folks need to move quickly. I think the framework and the parameters are there for a good proposal, and we'd like to get this moving. I certainly hear your concern.
My apologies for not having written
no problem.
Money, and I will turn it in tomorrow.
You're off the hook.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Anybody else wishing to testify?
All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3238. I think that concludes the business before the committee. Good job, you guys. Thank you very much. We'll be back in.
Good job, Madam Chair.
Thank you.